Section 3. The Black Abyss. September 1987. Chapter 23. The forbidding beauty of pure, absolute black pressed against the viewport and blotted out all touch with earthly reality. The total absence of light, Albert Giordino judged, took only a few minutes to shift the human mind into a state of confused disorder. He had the impression of falling from a vast height with his eyes closed on a moonless night, falling through an immense black void without the tiniest fragment of sensation. Finally, a bead of sweat trickled over his brow and dropped into his left eye, stinging it. He shook off the spell, wiped a sleeve across his face, and gently eased a hand over the control panel immediately in front of him, touching the various and familiar protrusions until his probing fingers reached their goal. Then he flicked the switch upward. The lights attached to the hull of the deep-sea submersible flashed on and cut a brilliant swath through the eternal night. Although the narrow sides of the beam abruptly turned a blackish blue, the tiny organisms floating past the direct glare reflected the light for several feet above and below the area around the viewport. Turning his face so as not to fog the thick plexiglass, Giordino expelled a heavy sigh and then leaned back against the soft padding of the pilot's chair. It was nearly a full minute before he bent over the control console and began bringing the silent craft to life again. He studied the rows of dials until the wavering needles were calibrated to his satisfaction, and he scanned the circuit lights, making certain they all blinked out their green message of safe operation before he re-engaged the electrical systems of the Cepho-1. The Cepho-1. He swung the chair and gazed idly down the center passageway toward the stern. It might have been the newest and largest research submersible in the world, to the National Underwater and Marine Agency, but to Al Giordino, the first time he set eyes on it, the general design looked like a giant cigar on an ice skate. The Cepho-1 wasn't built to compete with military submarines. She was functional. Scientific survey of the ocean bottom was her game, and every square inch was utilized to accommodate a 7-man crew and 2 tons of oceanographic research instruments and equipment. The Cepho-1 would never fire a missile or cut through the sea at 70 knots. But then she could operate where no other submarine had ever dared to go, 24,000 feet below the ocean surface. Yet Giordino was never totally at ease. He checked the depth gauge, wincing at the reading of almost 12,500 feet. The pressure of the sea increases at the rate of 15 pounds per square inch for every 30 feet. He winced again when his mental gymnastics gave him an approximate answer of nearly 6,200 pounds per square inch, the pressure which at that moment was pushing against the red paint on the Cepho-1's thick titanium skin. "How about a cup of fresh sediment?" Giordino looked up into the unsmiling face of Omar Woodson, the photographer on the mission. Woodson was carrying a steaming mug of coffee. "The chief valve and switch pusher should have had his brew exactly 5 minutes ago," said Giordino. "Sorry, some idiot turned out the lights." Woodson handed him the mug. "Everything check out?" "Okay, across the board," Giordino answered. "I gave the aft battery section a rest. We'll juice off the center section for the next 18 hours. "Lucky we didn't drift into a rock outcropping when we shut down." "Surely you jest." Giordino slid down in his seat, squinted his eyes, and yawned with effortless finesse. "Sonar hasn't picked out anything larger than a baseball-sized rock in the last 6 hours. The bottom here is as flat as my girlfriend's stomach." "You mean chest," Woodson said. "I've seen her picture." Woodson was smiling, which was rare for him. "Nobody's perfect," Giordino conceded. "However, considering the fact her father is a wealthy liquor distributor, I can overlook her bad points." He broke off as Rudy Gunn, the commander of the mission, leaned into the pilot's compartment. He was short and thin, and his wide eyes, magnified by a pair of horn-rimmed glasses, peered intently over a large Roman nose, giving him the look of an undernourished owl about to strike. Yet his appearance was deceiving. Rudy Gunn was warm and kind. Every man who ever served under his command respected him enormously. "You two at it again," Gunn smiled tolerantly. Woodson looked solemn. "The same old problem. He's getting horny for his girl again." After 51 days on this drifting closet, even his grandmother would forgive the gleam in his eye. Gunn leaned over Giordino and gazed through the viewport. For a few seconds only, a dim blue filled his eyes. Then, gradually, just below the Sappho 1, he could make out the reddish ooze of the top layer of bottom sediment. For a brief moment, a bright red shrimp, barely over an inch long, floated across the beam of the light before it vanished into the darkness. "Damn shame we can't get out and walk around," Gunn said as he stepped back. "No telling what we might find out there." "Same thing you'd find in the middle of the Mojave Desert," Giordino grunted. "Absolutely zilch." He reached up and tapped the gauge. "Colder temperature, though. I read a rousing 34.8 degrees Fahrenheit. "A great place to visit," Woodson said, "but you wouldn't want to spend your golden years there." "Anything show on sonar?" Gunn asked. Giordino nodded at a large green screen in the middle of the panel. The reflected pattern of the terrain was flat. "Nothing ahead or to the sides. The profile hasn't wavered for several hours." Gunn wearily removed his glasses and rubbed his eyes. "Okay, gentlemen, our mission is as good as ended. We'll give it another 10 hours, then we surface." Almost as a reflex action, he looked up at the overhead panel. "Is Mother still with us?" Giordino nodded. "Mother is hanging in there." He needed only to glance at the fluctuating needle on the transducer instrument to know that the mothership, a surface support tender, was continuously tracking the Sappho 1 on sonar. "Make contact," Gunn said, "and signal Mother that we'll begin our ascent at 0900 hours. That should leave them plenty of time to load us aboard and take the Sappho 1 in tow before sunset." "I've almost forgotten what a sunset looks like," Woodson murmured. "It's off to the beach to recapture a suntan and ogle all those gorgeous bikini-clad honeys for Papa Woodson. No more of these deep-sea funny farms for me." "Thank God the end is in sight," Giordino said. "Another week cooped up in this overgrown wiener and I'll start talking to the potted plants." Woodson looked at him. "We don't have any potted plants." "You get the picture." Gunn smiled. "Everybody deserves a good rest. You men have put on a fine show. The data we've compiled should keep the lab boys busy for a long time." Giordino turned to Gunn, gave him a long look, and spoke slowly. "This has been one hell of a weird mission, Rudy." "I don't get your meaning," Gunn said. "A poorly cast drama is what I mean. Take a good look at your crew." He gestured to the four men working in the aft section of the submersible. Ben Drummer, a lanky southerner with a deep Alabama drawl. Rick Spencer, a short, blond-haired Californian who whistled constantly through clenched teeth. Sam Merker, as cosmopolitan and citified as a Wall Street broker. And Henry Monk, a quiet, droopy-eyed wit who clearly wished he were anywhere but on the Sappho 1. "Those clowns aft, you, Woodson, and myself. We're all engineers, nuts and bolts mechanics. There isn't a Ph.D. in the lot." "The first men on the moon weren't intellectuals either," Gunn countered. "It takes the nuts and bolts mechanics to perfect the equipment. You guys have proven the Sappho 1. You've demonstrated her capabilities. Let the next ride go to the oceanographers. As for us, this mission will go down in the books as a great scientific achievement." "I am not," Giordino declared pontifically, "cut out to be a hero." "Neither am I, pal," Woodson added. "But you've got to admit, it beats hell out of selling life insurance." "The drama of it all escapes him," Gunn said. Think of the stories you can tell your girlfriends. Think of the enraptured looks on their pretty faces when you tell them how you unerringly piloted the greatest undersea probe of the century. Unerringly? Giardino said. Then suppose you tell me why I'm running this scientific marvel around in circles 500 miles off our scheduled course? Gunn shrugged. Orders. Giardino stared at him. We're supposed to be under the Labrador Sea. Instead, Admiral Sandecker changes our course at the last minute and makes us chase all over the abyssal plains below the Grand Banks of Newfoundland. It doesn't make sense. Gunn smiled a sphinx-like smile. For several moments, none of the men spoke. But Gunn didn't require a concentrated dose of ESP to know the questions that were running through their minds. They were, he was certain, thinking what he was thinking. Like himself, they were 3 months back in time and 2,000 miles in distance, at the headquarters of the National Underwater and Marine Agency in Washington, D.C., where Admiral James Sandecker, chief director of the agency, was describing the most incredible undersea operation of the decade. "God damn," Admiral Sandecker had thundered. "I'd give up a year's salary if I could join you men." A figure of speech, Giardino reflected. Next to Sandecker, Ebenezer Scrooge spent money like a drunken sailor. Giardino relaxed in a deep leather sofa and tuned in to the Admiral's briefing, while idly blowing smoke rings between puffs on a giant cigar, lifted from a box on Sandecker's immense desk, when everyone's attention was focused on a wall map of the Atlantic Ocean. "Well, there she is." Sandecker rapped the pointer loudly on the map for the second time. "The Lorelei Current. She's born off the western tip of Africa, follows the mid-Atlantic ridge north, then curves easterly between Baffin Island and Greenland, and then dies in the Labrador Sea." Giardino said, "I don't hold a degree in oceanography, Admiral, but it would seem that the Lorelei converges with the Gulf Stream." "Not hardly. The Gulf Stream is surface water. The Lorelei is the coldest, heaviest water in the world's oceans, averaging 14,000 feet in depth." "Then the Lorelei crosses under the Gulf Stream," Spencer said softly. It was the first time in the briefing he had spoken. "That seems reasonable." Sandecker paused, smiled benevolently, then continued. "The ocean is basically made up of two layers, a surface or upper layer, heated by the sun and thoroughly churned by winds, and a cold, very dense layer consisting of intermediate, deep, and bottom water, and the two never mix." "Sound very dull and forbidding," Monk said. "The mere fact that some character with a black sense of humor named the current after a Rhine nymph who lured sailors onto the rocks makes it the last place I'd want to visit." A grim smile crawled slowly over Sandecker's griffin face. "Get used to the name, gentlemen, because deep in the Lorelei's gut is where we're going to spend 50 days. Where you're going to spend 50 days. "Doing what?" Woodson asked defiantly. "The Lorelei Current Drift Expedition is exactly what it sounds like. You men will descend in a deep-water submersible 500 miles northwest of the coast of Dakar and begin a submerged cruise in the current. Your main job will be to monitor and test the sub and its equipment. If there are no malfunctions that would necessitate cutting short the mission, you should surface around the middle of September in the approximate center of the Labrador Sea." Merker cleared his throat softly. "No submersible has stayed that long, that deep." "You want to back out, Sam?"
"Well, no."
"This is a volunteer expedition. Nobody is twisting your arm to go."
"Why us, Admiral?"
Ben Drummer uncoiled his lean frame from the floor where he had been comfortably stretched. "I'm a marine engineer. Spencer here is an equipment engineer. And Merka is a systems expert. I can't see where we fit in." "You're all professionals in your respective capacities. Woodson is also a photographer. The SAFO-1 will be carrying a number of photographic systems. Monk is the best instrument component man in the agency. And you'll all be under the command of Rudy Gunn, who has captained at one time or another
every research ship in Numa.
That leaves me, Giardino said. Sandecker glared at the cigar jutting from Giardino's mouth, recognized it as one from his private brand, and gave him a withering look that was completely ignored. As Assistant Projects Director for the agency, you'll be in overall charge of the mission. You can also make yourself useful by piloting the craft.
Giardino smiled devilishly and stared back. My pilot's license authorizes me to fly airplanes, not submarines.
The Admiral stiffened ever so slightly.
You'll just have to trust my judgment, won't you? Sandecker said coldly. Besides, what matters most is that you're the best crew I've got on hand at the moment. You all worked together on the Beaufort Sea expedition. You are men with heavy experience and records of ability and ingenuity. You can operate every instrument, every piece of oceanographic equipment yet invented. We'll let the scientists analyze the data you bring back, and, as I mentioned, naturally, you're all volunteers.
Naturally, Giardino echoed, his face deadpan. Sandecker went back behind his desk.
You will assemble and begin procedure training at our Key West port facility the day after tomorrow. The Pelham Aircraft Company has already run extensive diving tests on the submersible, so you need only concern yourselves with familiarization of the equipment and instructions on the experiments you'll conduct during the expedition.
Spencer whistled through his teeth.
An aircraft company? Holy God, what do they know about designing a deep-sea submersible?
For your peace of mind, Sandecker said patiently, Pelham turned its aerospace technology toward the sea 10 years ago. Since then, they've constructed 4 underwater environmental laboratories and 2 extremely successful submersibles for the Navy.
They'd best have built this one good, Merker said. I'd be most distressed to find that it leaked at 14,000 feet.
Scared shitless, you mean, Giardino mumbled.
Monk rubbed his eyes, then stared at the floor as though he saw the bottom of the sea in the carpet. When he spoke, his words came very slowly.
Is this trip really necessary, Admiral?
Sandecker nodded solemnly.
It is. Oceanographers need a picture of the structure of the Lorelei's flow pattern to improve their knowledge of deep ocean circulation. Believe me, this mission is as important as the first manned orbit around the Earth. Besides testing the world's most advanced submersible, you will be visually recording and mapping an area never before seen by man. Forget your doubts. The Sappho-1 has every safety feature built into her hull that science can devise. You have my personal guarantee of a safe and comfortable voyage.
That's easy for him to say, Giardino thought idly. He won't be there